infinite complacence, people went to and fro over the earth about their little affairs, serene in the assurance of their dominion over this small, spinning fragment of solar driftwood, which by chance or design, man has inherited out of the dark mystery of time and space.
Why don't you ask me what it feels like to be a freak?
The power of a new generation.
Greetings, and you are listening to Savage Science Radio here at Jackalope 105 FM, and I am your host, Tracy Savage. Here's a little music to start off tonight.
My mother's dreams, I have my father's eyes. He can't take that.
As you are more than likely aware, on March 11th, a powerful magnitude 9.0 quake hit northeastern Japan, triggering a tsunami with 10-meter-high waves that reached the U.S. west coast. Today, Emperor Akihito has dramatically taken to the national TV airwaves and buoyed the spirits of his disaster-stricken citizens in an extraordinary address before a nation grappling with the aftermath of this epic earthquake and the devastating tsunami, and amid growing fears of a nuclear catastrophe. Here are his words.
被災者としての自らを励ましつつ
Currently, the entire nation is putting forth its best effort to save all suffering people. However, under the severe cold weather, evacuees are having a very difficult time because they lack food, water, and energy sources. I truly hope that we will be able to save lives and perhaps slightly improve the lives of victims. And hopefully with these efforts, we will be able to encourage victims and offer them hope as they try to recover. I am deeply concerned that the current nuclear plant situation is critical.
An address by a sitting emperor is usually reserved for times of extreme crisis or war. Emperor Akihito's direct appeal to the public is considered an exceptional thing in Japan and marks the first time that he has spoken to the public amid such a crisis. The 77-year-old ceremonial but deeply revered chief of state underlined Prime Minister Naoto Kan's earlier assertion that Japan is going through its worst crisis since World War II. It is not known whether he will visit survivors of the disaster as he did in 1995 after the deadly quake in Kobe. Now, nearly 13,000 people are dead or missing, and several hundred thousand have been left homeless from Friday's earthquake and tsunami. The emperor delivered this speech on the same day that white smoke and new blaze at the damaged Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant added to radiation fears, and we're going to talk more about that today with voices on here of some of the experts, one of which is Dr. Michio Kaku, and let's hear what he has to say about this.
So now we want to talk about what exactly is going on at that nuclear facility and that reactor. And for that, we're going to turn to Dr. Michio Kaku. There's so many questions about what just happened. What does it mean, though? What is the latest that you've heard?
Well, this could be a Chernobyl in the making. We are now going into uncharted territory. We are thinking the unthinkable. Think of a car out of control without brakes, and then your radiator explodes. That's the situation we have here, a runaway car that has no brakes, no emergency core cooling system, and now apparently a steam hydrogen explosion has blown the radiator off. Now, they were depressurizing the reactor just a few hours ago. It looked as if they were within a hair's breadth of bringing it under control. But then a steam hydrogen explosion took place, four workers got injured, and all hell is breaking loose.
Well, when you hear that term, a Chernobyl in the making, it's really scary. We do have a map this morning of the evacuation zone. It's 20 kilometers, 12 miles. How important is it to get out of that area, and how far away is safe?
Well, right now, the reactor itself, the vessel, seems to be intact. The Prime Minister just announced that the vessel still seems to be intact. At Chernobyl, the vessel and the roof blew off simultaneously, and 25% of the core, the uranium core, blew into the atmosphere. Here, we don't know how much core damage there is. That's the big question mark. But if there is core damage and radiation starts to leak out, 12 miles may not be enough. The winds don't stop blowing at 12 miles. The winds just keep on blowing.
And if we go inside the core of this reactor, what exactly are they most worried about?
The core is roughly 12 feet tall, super hot uranium that has to be covered with water at all times. Apparently, maybe some of the core is being exposed. At that point, temperatures rise rapidly to 5,000 degrees. Uranium core begins to splinter and melt. Radioactive gas starts to shoot out of the reactor, and that's the China syndrome. And so we're worried that we could be in the initial stages of core damage and core melt.
Okay, so in a worst-case scenario, what kind of risk is posed to people who live nearby?
We're not talking Hiroshima. We're not talking about radiation burns over people's bodies. We're talking about a colorless steam cloud coming out of the reactor containing cesium, strontium, iodide in radioactive form that then drifts downstream into people's homes, lungs, into your clothing, into your hair. And that in turn could cause lung cancer, it could cause thyroid cancer, leukemia. At Chernobyl, we're still seeing the effects of that accident, and that took place in 1986. We're still seeing people dying of that reactor accident.
And given that there are still so many unknowns, we know that they expanded that perimeter as evacuation. Is even 12 miles, in your opinion, sufficient at this point?
The winds don't stop blowing at 12 miles. I would say as a safety precaution, just as a precaution, people should get out to perhaps 20 miles, given the fact that we have a situation that is not yet under control. That's the worrisome factor. We don't know the extent of core damage yet.
I know you're a physicist and not a physician, but and correct me if I'm wrong on that, but how can you tell if somebody has radiation poisoning, and is there any effective way to treat it?
Well, if I was a reporter going into that danger area, first of all, I would carry a Geiger counter because I want to know exactly what's out there. Radiation is invisible. We don't have any sensors that can detect radiation. You have to have a radiation sensor, and you have to then understand that some of it gets into your lungs, where it could radiate your lungs for years at a time, causing lung cancer. Thyroid cancer could occur because radioactive iodine comes out. Radioactive strontium comes out. That accumulates in the bone, and you can also have leukemia as a consequence. So there's a whole list of medical effects caused by radioactive accidents like this.
And when folks at home hear the term meltdown, it sparks a lot of fear. What exactly does a meltdown constitute?
The meltdown is when the core of uranium, which is roughly 12 feet tall, weighs 100 tons, super hot core, its cooling water starts to drop. At that point, the metal starts to begin to melt at about 5,000 degrees and starts to splinter. At Three Mile Island, about 90% of the core was uncovered, and the core splintered, and it looked like a bowl of granola when we actually took pictures of the core at Three Mile Island. At Chernobyl, the reactor exploded. The core melted, got shot right through the ceiling. About 25% of the core shot into the roof and caused enormous radioactive damage throughout the whole area near Kiev.
There are so many unknowns about what's going on at that nuclear facility and that reactor. Specifically, when you hear word of all of these aftershocks, 6.0 aftershock, how is that affecting the understanding of what's going on there at the reactor?
The danger is that a secondary aftershock could push this damaged reactor over the tipping point. We're talking about a broken pipe. We're talking about leaking this very important cooling water out of the core, exposing the core. And remember, they were trying to depressurize it. Think of a pressure cooker. They were trying to relieve the pressure on this reactor, which was building up pressure 50% above design level. And apparently, they let the lid off too quickly, and a steam hydrogen gas explosion blew the building. So it means that the reactor is basically unstable yet. They don't have it under control. And that's what's worrisome.
How much danger is there for continuing aftershocks in this kind of environment?
The aftershocks could go on for days.
Days.
And just remember that it doesn't take much to tip a broken reactor into the meltdown zone. And that's the danger that we face here.
So now it's just basically a race against time to stabilize the reactor before we see the further.
Engineers are keeping their fingers crossed. It's a race against time because on one hand, the reactor is degrading. On one hand, pressures are building up, temperatures are rising, water levels could be dropping. On the other hand, we have aftershocks. The reactor is weakened. Pipes could break right open. And if that happens, we're talking about a China syndrome Chernobyl accident. And remember that Chernobyl started with a hydrogen steam explosion, just like what just happened a few hours ago at that Japanese plant. We could be having deja vu all over again.
But Chernobyl did not start from an earthquake.
That's right.
It's even scarier aftershocks to have to worry about. Dr. Kaku, thank you. We appreciate it.
And another big question that we have is, what are the effects of nuclear radiation on the body? Now let's listen to this expert report.
I'm here with Dr. Richard Besser because we want to know the effects on the body.
That's
when
right.
it comes to this.
You know, when you're exposed to radiation, it's going to affect your entire body. But there are three parts of the body I want to talk about that are affected most. The first is your GI tract, your gastrointestinal tract. When you're exposed to radiation, it can cause damage to that tract in the same way that someone undergoing cancer therapy will have damage to that. So they'll experience nausea, vomiting, diarrhea. If you have large amounts of input of radiation, it can destroy the lining, which can be fatal. Mm. The second part I want to talk about is your thyroid gland. That's in your neck. This is your thyroid. It makes a hormone that your body uses to regulate many, many functions. But it does that by using iodine. And one of the things released by reactors is radioactive iodine. It comes into your body and your thyroid gland will concentrate it. And over the long run, that will cause cancer. That's a reason why they give people these iodine tablets.
Well, what do they do, actually, these tablets?
Well, instead of your body absorbing the radioactive iodine, it will use this instead. And that will protect your thyroid from that cancer. Mm-hmm. The third area I want to talk about is your bones, your bone marrow. Inside your bones, that's where your body is making all the components of your blood. Your white blood cells would protect against infection. Your platelets would protect against bleeding. With radiation, it can wipe that out, and that can cause bleeding, and it can cause infection, and those things can be fatal.
Before we talk about the risk factors that are involved here, but the symptoms, are you coughing? What are you exactly doing knowing that you are exposed to this radiation?
Well, the earliest signs are those from your gastrointestinal tract, so nausea, vomiting, fever, diarrhea. The unfortunate thing is those can look like a stomach flu, and when you have all these people being evacuated, you can see that, and they'll have to sort out the difference between those two.
All right, so let's get to the risk factors now.
It's important to know what puts you at greatest risk. First is proximity. How close are you to the release of that radiation? The second factor is intensity. How much radiation is released, and is there any barrier between you and that radiation? Those barriers, even being indoors, can reduce the risk to you. And then the third is duration. How long are you there? One of the things that was known from Chernobyl was that the iodine release that people were first exposed to wasn't the big risk factor. That iodine fell on the ground and contaminated grass. Cows ate that grass and it was concentrated in their milk. So over the next months and years, children were drinking contaminated milk and they had massive outbreaks of thyroid cancer.
So it was in that manner in which it got into the body, not so much the exposure.
That's right. So you'll see here, the Japanese will say, don't eat food, don't drink things that come from that area that's been impacted.
If people are concerned, you're going to have suggestions of what they can do?
ABCnews.com will be putting out tips on what you can do, and I'll be tweeting all day. Things you can do to make sure you're not affected should there be a release.
All right, Rich, thank you very much.
Now, a lot of people want to know if seawater can be used. So is seawater a last resort to cooling Japan's nuclear reactors? Well, as the situation at Japan's 40-year-old Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant goes from bad to worse as right before our eyes, four of this planet's six boiling water reactors have been damaged by explosions or fire, and radiation has begun leaking into the atmosphere. Officials there continue to pump seawater into the reactors in a desperate attempt to cool down fuel rods and to avoid a complete meltdown, as these reports have talked about, that could release radioactive fallout across much of the country and beyond. The move by Tokyo Electric Power Company, TEPCO, which operates Daiichi, is to use seawater doped with neutron-absorbing boron in the reactor's pressure vessels, but all ensures that they will never function properly again, permanently damaging one of the world's 25 largest nuclear power stations. Such extreme measures were necessary because the normal and auxiliary cooling systems, which circulate purified water to keep the fuel rods from melting down, failed. Last week's tsunami not only cut normal power, electrical power to Daiichi, but it also flooded and disabled the backup diesel generators. Three of the plant's six reactors were already shut down for maintenance when the magnitude 9.0 earthquake-induced tsunami struck, but TEPCO has struggled to cool the fuel rods used in operational reactors. The lack of sufficient water to cover these rods have led to explosions at all three active reactors, as was described, likely due to a buildup of hydrogen gas. Now, a fourth reactor, one of those that had been shut down prior to March 11th, experienced a fire yesterday that threatened to evaporate water in a storage pool for spent nuclear fuel. Now, that fire may have been caused by hydrogen seeping from the pool. Which is NIKKEI.com, reported, and the prospect of ruining a half a dozen nuclear reactors pales in comparison with the alternative, a complete meltdown that would contaminate the ground below the complex with radioactive material that could be spread by wind, rain, and groundwater, potentially causing radiation sickness, as we just heard, in thousands of people. Scientific American spoke with Pavel Svetkov, an assistant nuclear engineering professor at Texas A&M University in College Station, about why seawater is a last resort for cooling compromised nuclear reactors at TEPCO's options moving forward. This is an edited transcript. Now, they asked, why does a nuclear facility normally rely on purified water to cool its reactors? How is it purified? He says, I'll give you an example. If you have a boiling pot and your water has too many minerals, then condensation will collect inside your boiling pot. When this happens in a reactor, it interrupts the properties of the fuel elements. Energy companies don't want to jeopardize the performance of their reactor material, so they use purified water, usually from a special water purification plant on site. Purifying the water removes most of the salts and anything that could accumulate on fuel elements. Then they asked, under what circumstances would a nuclear power plant use seawater to cool its reactors? Now he answered, using unpurified water is not a normal practice. It's never done. Plants don't take water from the river or the sea to supplement their own internal water, which is a completely closed-loop system. Now, of course, they take in some amount of new water periodically to make up for evaporation and other losses like that, but this water is purified before it's used. TEPCO's reactors lost the water below the normal operating conditions, so they had to provide additional water for that. Salt water obviously has a lot of minerals in it, and if it's taken directly from the sea, it has all sorts of other materials floating in it. Even if these things were filtered out, the chemistry of salt water is not really compatible with what normally goes through the reactor. It's too corrosive for fuel elements. I would guess that after this water was introduced into the reactor cores, those cores would become completely unstable. This is because any materials in the water would attach to the surface of the fuel rods and make heat transfer unpredictable. Then they asked, what role does boron in the seawater play? And he answered, boron can be injected into water coolant systems to control the activity of a reactor core because it is a strong neutron absorber, especially for thermal neutrons. But boron is not usually used in boiling water reactors such as those at the Diachi because the boron is also corrosive on fuel elements. In cases of emergency, however, boron and seawater can be used to suppress fission chain reactions in the fuel elements. And then they asked, so the use of seawater and boron is a last resort effort to cool a reactor? And he answered, probably if they had more time, they would have tried to restore the diesel generators that ran the backup cooling system and circulate the water that they already had. But with the water in the core evaporating due to high temperatures, they needed to add more and more water so they could quickly suppress boiling conditions. And the last question, given that it costs several billion dollars to build a new reactor, isn't there any way they could clean the fuel elements? They may try to explore whether the reactor can be restored because it's a significant investment, but I'm not aware of anyone ever using salt water for any prolonged period of time in their reactors like they are doing now. And with all of these disasters, it has raised questions. Could something like this happen in America? Well, here's a report from the experts on that particular topic.
In the last year, we've now seen three major earthquakes in the Pacific. The most powerful, of course, this one in Japan over the weekend, but also in Chile and New Zealand. That has a lot of experts concerned that one could now be triggered on our own Pacific coast. We want to talk about that now with Dr. Michio Kaku, who's back with us again. And the real one of the concerns is that you would get about a 9-point earthquake up here around the Aleutian Islands.
That's right. This is not Hollywood anymore. It's actually happened. The second largest earthquake on recorded history off the coast of Alaska. And it could send a tidal wave 15 feet tall that could hit Los Angeles.
And there's another concern of one, though, right off the Pacific coast.
That's right. In 1812, we had another earthquake. And again, the potential here is that within a few minutes to 5 hours, a wall of water 15 feet tall could hit Los Angeles and go 2 to 3 miles inland.
So let's dig into more what that would mean for Los Angeles, what kind of destruction we would see if there were an earthquake first.
Well, let's say we have an 8.0 earthquake, smaller than the one that hit Japan. According to the
U.S. Right on the San Andreas Fault?
Right on the San Andreas Fault. And according to the U.S. Geological Survey, the devastation would be catastrophic. Downtown Los Angeles flattened. 40% could withstand an 8.0 earthquake, but 15% of tall buildings are at risk and could, in fact, collapse.
So does that mean that we're not as well prepared as the Japanese were, say, in Tokyo?
Exactly. The Japanese are the world's best in terms of preparing for earthquakes. And look what happened to Kobe. Look what happened to Sendai. And look at the casualties in Los Angeles. 3,000 dead, up to 50,000 injured, and the fires, 6,000 to 7,000 raging fires out of control. Remember that in San Francisco in 1906, my grandfather witnessed it. Fires caused more damage than the earthquake itself.
And then, of course, there's also the concern of a tsunami and what that would mean for the various areas around Los Angeles, starting with L.A. Harbor.
That's right. L.A. Harbor would perhaps experience the worst damage in case of a tsunami. Again, a wall of water 15 feet tall going 2 to 3 miles inland. Santa Monica, believe it or not, would not experience as much damage because of the geometry, but Orange County, Newport Beach, Seal Beach, Huntington Beach would also sustain massive flooding.
Look how deep it goes in there.
Okay. That's right. So we're talking about whole areas being flooded. And some of these areas are very wealthy and they're very vulnerable. I wouldn't buy beachfront property there.
Okay. Well, Dr. Kaku, thanks very much. A sobering prediction there. And we asked you what you think, if America's ready for the disaster or not. An incredible 92% of you said no.
Well, those are some of the words of the experts in taking a look at this horrible tragedy. And I'd like to take a little music break here with some music from X-Men. It's Live, the last song.
Thank you.
Now, what might be confusing to an awful lot of people right now is what happens during a nuclear meltdown specifically. These nuclear reactors at the Fukushima Daiichi Station in Japan are critically endangered, of course, but have not reached full meltdown status, although we have just seen them completely evacuated. Our nuclear primer explains what that means and how the situation compares with past nuclear accidents. How does a nuclear reactor work? Most nuclear reactors, including those at Japan's Fukushima Daiichi Generating Station, are essentially high-tech kettles that efficiently boil water to produce electricity. They rely on harnessing nuclear fission, the splitting of an atom into two smaller atoms, which also yields heat and sends neutrons flying. If another atom absorbs one of those neutrons, the atom becomes unstable and undergoes fission itself, releasing more heat and more neutrons. The chain reaction becomes self-sustaining, producing a steady supply of heat to boil water, drive steam turbines, and therefore generate electricity. How much electricity does nuclear power provide in Japan and elsewhere? Well, 54 nuclear reactors generating 28 billion kilowatt hours annually. Japan is the world's third largest producer of nuclear power after the U.S. and France, according to data from the International Atomic Energy Agency. The Fukushima Daiichi Station, which has been hit hard by the March 11th earthquake, houses six of those reactors, all of which came online in the 1970s. Worldwide nuclear energy accounts for about 15% of energy generation. Japan gets nearly 30% of its electricity from nuclear plants. The U.S. produces more nuclear power overall, but nuclear constitutes a smaller share of its energy portfolio. About 20% of U.S. electricity comes from nuclear power plants, making it the third largest source of electricity in the country after coal, which is 45%, and natural gas, which is 23%. What fuels a nuclear reactor? Well, most nuclear reactors use uranium fuel that has been enriched in uranium-235, an isotope of uranium that fissions readily. Now, isotopes are variants of elements with different atomic masses. Uranium-238 is much more common in nature than uranium-235, but does not fission well. So, fuel manufacturers boost the uranium-235 content to a few percent, which is enough to maintain a continuous fission reaction and generate electricity. Enriched uranium is manufactured into fuel rods that are encased in metal cladding made of alloys such as zirconium. Reactor number 3 at the Fukushima Daiichi Station runs on so-called mixed oxide, MOX, fuel, in which uranium is mixed with other fissile materials such as plutonium and spent reactor fuel from decommissioned nuclear weapons. How do you turn off a nuclear reaction? Sustained nuclear fission reactions rely on the passing of neutrons from one atom to the other, and the neutrons released in one atom's fissioning trigger the fissioning of the next atom. The way to cut off a fission chain reaction, then, is to intercept the neutrons. Nuclear reactors utilize control rods made from elements such as cadmium, boron, or hafnium, all of which are efficient neutron absorbers. Now, when the reactor malfunctions or when operators need to shut off the reactor or any other reason, technicians can remotely plunge control rods into the reactor core to soak up neutrons and shut down the nuclear reaction. And then the next question would be, can a reactor melt down once a nuclear reaction is stopped? Even after the control rods have done their job and arrested the fission reaction, the fuel rods retain a great deal of heat. What is more, uranium atoms that have already split into two produce radioactive byproducts that themselves give off a great deal of heat, so the reactor core continues to produce heat in the absence of fissioning. Now, if the rest of the reactor is operating normally, pumps will continue to circulate coolant, usually water, that we talked about, that purified water, to carry away the reactor's core heat. In Japan, the March 11th earthquake and tsunami caused blackouts that nearly cut off the externally sourced AC power for the reactor's cooling system. According to published reports, backup diesel generators at the power plant failed shortly thereafter, leaving the reactors uncooled and in serious danger of overheating. Without a steady coolant coolant supply, a hot reactor core will continuously boil off water surrounding it until the fuel is no longer immersed. If the fuel rods remain uncovered, they may begin to melt. Hot and hot radioactive fuel can pull down at the bottom of the vessel containing the reactor. In a worst-case meltdown scenario, the puddle of hot fuel could melt through the steel containment vessel and through subsequent barriers meant to contain these nuclear materials, exposing massive quantities of radioactivity to the outside world. Now, how can a meltdown be averted? The Japanese plant's operator have made a number of attempts to cool the reactors, including pumping seawater that we just talked about into the reactor core to replenish the dwindling cooling fluid. The Tokyo Electric Power Company has also injected boric acid, an absorber of neutrons, into the reactors. How does this incident compare with the Chernobyl or Three Mile Island? Well, at present, the three of the reactors at the Fukushima Daiichi station are seriously crippled. Units 1 and 3 have experienced explosions that destroyed exterior walls, apparently from buildups of hydrogen gas produced by the zirconium in the fuel rods reacting with coolant water at extremely high temperatures. But the interior containment vessels are thus far from to be intact. Now, a third explosion was reported on March 15th at reactor number 2, and the situation appears dire. Now, pressure in the suppression pool, the donut-shaped water vessel below the reactor that we talked about, dropped after the explosion, indicating that the containment vessel had been compromised. In the reactors number 1, 2, and 3, water levels dropped enough that to leave the fuel assemblies temporarily uncovered. Those fuel rods are presumed to have suffered damage, and a fire at a pool storing spent rods at dormant reactor number 4 is posing additional hazards to the few workers that were remaining there on the site. And of course, everybody's been evacuated now, but the Japanese officials initially rated the incident at a level 4, an accident with local consequences on the 7-tier International Nuclear and Radiological Event Scale, INUS. But Princeton University physicist Frank von Hippel told the New York Times that Fukushima Daiichi situation is, quote, way past Three Mile Island already, unquote. Three Mile Island, the highest U.S. Nuclear accident, was classified at level 5, an accident with, quote, wider consequences, unquote. Now, at that Pennsylvania nuclear station in 1979, a cooling malfunction combined with a worker error led to a partial meltdown. At about half of the reactor core melted and formed a radioactive puddle at the bottom of the steel pressure vessel. The vessel remained intact, but some radiation did escape from the plant into the surrounding environment. And now, regarding the 1986 Chernobyl accident, it was far more devastating. It rates a 7, or a major accident on the INUS scale. In the Ukraine, then part of the Soviet Union, a power surge caused an explosion in one of the plant's reactors, releasing huge doses of radioactive fallout into the air. Two plant workers died within hours, according to the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and 28 more died in the following months from radiation poisoning. The fallout from Chernobyl is widespread, and the health effects of the disaster are difficult to quantify. A report from the UN Scientific Committee on the Effects of Atomic Radiation found that 6,000 individuals were under the age of 18 in the Ukraine. Belarus, or Russia, at the time of the disaster, had by 2006 contracted thyroid cancer, a substantial fraction of whom likely contracted the disease due to radiation exposure. Now, in an effort to help aid those that have been victims in this terrible disaster, you can donate through Jackalope Radio Station, Jackalope 105 FM, and that is it has a clickable link on it. You can also text Red Cross, REDCROSS, to 90999 to give $10 for the Japan earthquake and Pacific tsunami. Your $10 gift to the American Red Cross will support our disaster relief efforts to help those affected by the earthquake in Japan and tsunami throughout the Pacific. On those rare occasions when donations exceed American Red Cross expenses for a specific disaster, contributions are used to prepare for and serve victims of other disasters. Charges will appear on your wireless bill or be deducted from your prepaid balance. All purchases must be authorized by account holder. Message and data rates may apply. Text STOP to 90999 to stop. Text HELP to 90999 for help. Now you can see the full terms and applicable to donations, and you can visit www.mgive.org/T. Well, that about does it for Savage Science Radio this week. I wish it could be a happier report. Of course, in light of this tragedy, we're doing the best we can to give you information and knowledge so that you can understand what's happening in the world around you. I'd like to thank Dennis Bond and Hawk Productions for the fantastic intro I use every week, Nick Palucco for the beautiful show graphics, Walid Al-Adad for helping me research some of these items that I bring to you every week, and to my executive producer, Todd Sheets at Jackalope105, the one and only. And until next week, keep your powder in your pants dry and try to have happy trails until we meet again.
We'd like to do something for you from our farewell to Pink Sound. This is called Closer to the Heart.